We're still in Mark chapter 8. It's a big chapter. This morning we're going to look at verses 22 to 31 of Mark chapter 8. And let me read the passage for you to begin. So hopefully you found it in your Bible. And God's word says, "And they came to Bethsaida, and they brought a blind man to Jesus and implored him to touch him. Taking the blind man by the hand, Jesus brought him out of the village. And after spitting on his eyes and laying his hands on him, he asked him, 'Do you see anything?' And he, regaining his sight, said, 'I see men, for I see them like trees walking around.' Then again he laid his hands on his eyes, and he looked intently and was restored, and began to see everything clearly. And Jesus sent him to his home, saying, 'Do not even enter the village.' And Jesus went out along with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi. And on the way he questioned his disciples, saying to them, 'Who do people say that I am?' And they told him, saying, 'John the Baptist, and others say Elijah, but others one of the prophets.' And he continued by questioning them, 'But who do you say that I am?' And Peter answered and said to him, 'You are the Christ.' And he warned them to tell no one about him. And he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things, and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes, and be killed, and after 3 days rise again." All right, that's our passage for this morning. Let me set a little bit of context for you, because we're going through the Gospel of Mark. We've almost been in here for a year now, believe it or not, and another 6 or 7 years and I should be through, but it probably won't be that long. Anyway, I've never preached longer than 4 years in any Gospel, if that's an encouragement to you. That was the Gospel of Matthew. Yes, that's a while back. Anyway, Jesus is very concerned that his apostles understand clearly both who he is and what he has been sent by the Father to do. And we are realizing as we're reading Mark's gospel that they are struggling to understand those two very things. Who is this Jesus, and what is the mission that God has sent him upon? Last week in our passage, chapter 8, verses 13 to 21, we saw Jesus confronting the apostles because they were having a diminishing learning curve. Instead of picking up speed on learning and gaining more and more, they had more than just stalled. It seems like they were dropping off and learning less and less. And so Jesus gave them 3 warnings about this diminishing learning curve. Number one, he warned them to beware of inoculation. Now, I put that word in there. You won't find it in the text. But inoculation is when you get a little dose of something and then all of a sudden you start to build up resistance. Basically, what was happening was that Jesus' apostles knew a little bit about him, but it was as if that little bit of knowledge had actually stopped them from learning more. The whole idea of getting a shot so that you get an inert little amount of something, but it produces resistance to something later on. They'd become inoculated. Secondly, he warns them about calcification. The idea that soft tissue that should be pliable and workable and doing the function that God designed it for becomes hardened. And he had told them, and it's twice already, we'd been told in chapter 6 that there was a hardening of the heart going on, and then in chapter 8 Jesus says, "Do you have hardened hearts?" And this is the idea that they had lost some of the learning function. Hearts here is not so much an emotional thing, but the heart for the Hebrew was sort of the seat of all learning and understanding. And have you lost your ability to learn and to perceive? And the third thing he warned them about was fixation. And here we know the disciples were very concerned about the fact that they didn't have any bread in the boat. And Jesus says, "Do you remember when I fed the 5,000, how much was left over?" And they say, 12 baskets. And he said, "And when I fed the 4,000, how much was left over?" And that was 7 large baskets. And the idea is that Jesus asks them both times about the leftovers. not about the miracle, but about the leftovers. And what do the leftovers signify? The leftovers signify that Jesus is able to meet the immediate daily needs of his disciples. You don't need to be fixated about how am I going to get everything I need in this world. That doesn't mean that we should be irresponsible, but it does mean that we can't let the worldly pressures and the worldly fixations crowd out our ability to learn greater, deeper spiritual truths. Anyway, Jesus is the master of using teaching devices. And this morning we're going to see two things. Number one, we're going to see Jesus use an illustration. And then we're going to see Jesus develop a number of lessons from this illustration. Now, how many of you like it when pastors use illustrations in their sermons? Why do you like that? Because that's usually the funny, enjoyable parts, right? The rest of the sermon is the misery, but it's those illustrations that is what you like. And the thing that bugs every preacher is that people inevitably only remember the illustrations. Makes pastors want to never give an illustration. And over the years, you know, I've been trying to work on my preaching, and I do look at places where they provide illustrations for me to use. In fact, I got a book downstairs, a great big red-covered thing called 7,700 Illustrations. What a great book. I can just get lost for hours reading these things. It's kind of like a spiritualized Reader's Digest. You know what the problem is? I have never once, I've owned that book for 30 years, used a single illustration in a sermon from it. I used to subscribe to a pastor's magazine that gave wonderful illustrations. And you would assume a pastor's magazine, they would be useful. All of my friends who were preachers always used to say the same thing. Love the illustrations. Never once been able to use one. Why? Because they don't seem to illustrate an effective, immediate truth that we're trying to communicate from the Word. And you get lost in the illustration and you miss the lesson. Well, here Jesus is going to give an illustration, and I don't think you can miss the lesson that's coming with this, and that's why you don't stop the context this morning after verse 26. You continue on in 27, because there's the lesson. 22 to 26 is the illustration, 27 to 31 is the lesson. Now, the illustration will be the healing of a blind man. The lessons will come forth from that. What we want to see is there's some parallels here. Not only were the apostles suffering from learning-itis, they weren't learning anymore, but they seemed to be developing a rather severe case of spiritual blindness as well. And they needed to see things, and they needed to perceive things, and they needed to understand things. And so when Jesus uses this illustration of this blind man and the way that he heals him, it should be something that should have made an impact upon his apostles. That's saying, hey, that's us. And hey, we need some help here too, obviously. So there's a progressive restoring of spiritual insight in the lesson we're about to look at this morning. There's the overcoming of spiritual blindness here. There is the opening of the eyes of those who have become blind. Kind of goes with Isaiah 35, doesn't it? What does the Messiah do? One of the first things he does is that he makes the blind to see. Let me ask a question this morning. How does blindness happen? Well, usually one of two ways. Either you are born blind, and sadly a number of people are. That's part of being in the fallen world in which we live. But there's also the tragedy of losing your sight. You were born seeing, and then something has happened, and you no longer see anymore. That's really, I think, where this illustration falls in, because of the man who is blind here, I don't believe is born blind. I think the text would tell us that he became blind. What about spiritual blindness? Now, reality is we're all born that way. We're all spiritually blind from birth. But when Jesus begins to make us see, is it possible for us to then be seeing disciples and all of a sudden start to develop spiritual blindness? And sadly, I think that is a truth. What happens there? Well, when we cease to learn and when we cease to perceive, and in most cases, this is not because Jesus is not capable of keeping us seeing, it's because we are choosing to become obtuse. This is almost a choice of not seeing. There's an old saying that says, there just is no one so blind as he who will not see. And I kind of think that that applies to the apostles, and I know it applies to me, and I'm assuming it probably applies to you as well. That there are areas in which we are refusing to see and actually losing the capacity to see because of it. Now, where would you put Jesus' apostles? Are they born blind? Absolutely. Has Jesus called them and opened their eyes? Yes, he has. But are they becoming more and more spiritually blind? And I think the problem is they are. And this is a matter of blindness by choice. Now, I wouldn't call this a sin of commission, that they are high-handedly in rebellion against Jesus, saying, we're just going to listen to you anymore, Jesus. We've learned enough. I don't think that's the case. But the fact that they're not paying enough attention, and Jesus really does communicate that they should be able to understand what he's saying, because after all, there is no better teacher than Jesus. They should be able to clue in. And at the last passage we looked at, he says, don't you understand? That's where we ended. That it's a sort of a sin of omission. They're just too fixated. They're too inoculated. They're just not paying enough attention. All right, so this morning we're going to look at the illustration. We're going to see about a man who has gone blind. That's the first part. Then we're going to see how Jesus will touch this man and progressively restore him. And this makes this a very unique miracle in the Gospels. There is no other progressive restoration miracle. And by the way, only Mark has the blind man story, this one. We're going to look at how Jesus is able to do things. There's three actions that he does. He's going to open eyes, he's going to restore sight, and then he's going to clear vision. And then Jesus is going to give this man who has been healed of his blindness a prohibitive restriction. He's going to say, don't do something. All right? So there's the illustration. Then we're going to get into the lessons. And the lessons are, we're going to see how Jesus deliberately takes his apostles and separates them from the whole context of ministry and gets them alone and spends some quality time on them. He wants them to reflect and understand something. We're going to see one of the lessons is that we need to be very careful about public opinion and not let that form the basis of our understanding. The next thing we're going to see is that there's some very clear essentials that Jesus emphasizes. There's an essential question that he asks. There is an essential answer that must come to this question. And then there's an essential understanding that needs to go behind the answer. Jesus will then give his apostles a prohibitive restriction, telling them something he doesn't want them to do. And then in the last verse, verse 31, all of a sudden Jesus is going to open it up and start talking to them in ways that they have not heard. And he's going to describe who Messiah really is. All right, so let's go through this starting at verse 22. It says, and they came to Bethsaida. All right, now, for the most part, the public ministry of Jesus is really coming to an end. We're about 2.5 years into the 3-year ministry that Jesus has. A lot of that ministry is done in the region of Galilee. There's about 6 months to go now to the crucifixion. And really, Jesus is going to spend a great deal of time from this point on dealing specifically with his 12 apostles, because these guys need to be adequately prepped and they need to understand the role that they are going to step into. Right now, they're just apostles in training, but they will become real apostles, real sent messengers and establishers of the church, and they've got to be ready for this. So the attention to the apostles' learning becomes a real dominant theme from this point on in this gospel. Bethsaida is the setting. Now, if you are looking at the Sea of Galilee and you think of a clock face, if you're old school and you remember clocks with numbers on them, and if I was to say to you, it's at 1 o'clock on the clock face, where would that be? That would be if 12 o'clock is straight north, just a little bit to the east of straight north. That's where Bethsaida is. Bethsaida is kind of the home port for about half of the apostles, but it's strategically an exit point out of Lower Galilee. There's actually two Galilees. Did you know that? There's Lower Galilee, where almost all of our gospel events take place. And then there's Upper Galilee that we know so very little about. It's far less populated. But Jesus is about to leave Lower Galilee and move up the east side of the Jordan River towards the region known as Caesarea Philippi. Now, who knows what Caesarea Philippi is? A few of you guys have been to Israel here. Caesarea sounds like Caesar, and that's right, it's a city named in honor of Caesar. Philippi sounds like Philip. This is Herod Philip, one of the Herod inheritors of the kingdom, a quarter king. We know that Caesarea Philippi sits up in the northernmost reach of ancient Israel. It's actually at the foot of a place called Mount Hermon. Now, Israel is reasonably mountainous and quite hilly. If you come from BC, you go, okay, those are good-sized hills, but they're not really mountains. If you come from Manitoba, wow, it's all big mountains everywhere in Israel. But there's one really high mountain in that region, and it's in the north, a little north of Caesarea Philippi. It's called Mount Hermon, all right? And it actually maintains snow up there kind of all year round. And if you see the River Jordan and you get down towards the south, it's a soupy, mucky, and polluted mess. But when you get up to the headwaters of the Jordan up by Hermon, what beautiful, cold, fresh water. I sat there, you know, in 110 degree heat with my feet in that water going, oh yeah, this is where I would be. Anyway, why are they heading up to this region? Well, Jesus does work his way through all of the ancient region of Israel. But in particular, when they go up towards Mount Hermon, something very special is going to happen up on Mount Hermon. Chapter 9 of Mark, we're going to see the transfiguration. This is where Jesus goes. It says he went up onto a high mountain. That's the high mountain of the region. Anyway, they're in Bethsaida. They're about to leave Galilee. Jesus is about to have some removed focused time with his apostles. And as they are going through Bethsaida, someone, it says they, and we don't know if this is the apostles or somebody else, but they brought a blind man to Jesus. Now, I'm going to suggest to you this morning that this is not a man born blind. This is a man who has become blind. And for reasons that we'll get a little farther down here. And they begged Jesus, they implored him to touch this blind man. You see, the notoriety and the fame of Jesus had gotten around, certainly up, and they're still in Lower Galilee. They had seen the bulk of the miracles. They knew that Jesus indeed could heal those who were blind. And so they bring this man to him. Now, Jesus takes the blind man by the hand. It's kind of like when he touches the ears and the tongue of the man who was deaf and mute. What do you do with a blind man? You take him by the hand because he needs to be led. And does he do the healing in a public setting? No. Look what it says. It says that he took the blind man by the hand and he brought him out of the village. Why? Well, I think for a couple of reasons. Number one, the fame of his healing had already spread far enough, and he didn't really need to make another spectacle of this, especially when he was going to give somebody's sight back. You don't need spectacles here. Oh, bad joke, okay? Actually, I think it's because he wants his apostles to pay special attention, and so there should be no distractions. It's just them and this blind man in a private setting. And after spitting on his eyes, whoo! Now, he could have spit on his fingers and put them on the eyes. I don't know. Why spit? When you get to heaven, please ask that question. I'm sure. There's lots of things suggest that I don't think any of them are all that convincing, but he spit on his eyes. And laying his hands on him. Now, this is regular practice for Jesus when he heals somebody, to put his hands on a personal touch. He asked him. Now, this is a first in any of the miracles that we've read. He sounds like a regular physician here. So how's that working? Do you see anything? Are we getting anywhere? Now, why would Jesus do this? And, of course, the suggestion is made, well, this was just a particularly difficult miracle. No. I don't think that Jesus ever had any particularly difficult miracles. I mean, he had the power of God. He just did something. But I think that this is part of the teaching illustration. He wants his disciples to see something. And what he wants them to see is that this is going to be a gradual restoring to sight. There are going to be multiple stages, at least two, in this particular restoration. Now, why is that significant? Because if this is an illustration for the disciples to understand their own spiritual blindness, how quickly are they going to regain their sight? Oh, it's going to be a graduated process. It's going to take some time to happen. He says to him, "Do you see anything?" Now, here's why I said that this guy is probably not born blind, but became blind. Verse 24, and I know all of your versions say, "And he looked up." Anna blepo, blepo being to see, Anna meaning either up or again. And it's much more natural in this passage to translate this, not that he looked up, but all of a sudden he saw again. Why do I say that? Well, what does he say? I see men. If he's born blind, when has he ever seen men? Even stranger, he says, I see men and I see them like trees. Now, what does a blind man know about trees besides walking into them? They are obstacles. You can put your arms around them. You can feel the bark. You can feel the leaves or the needles, whatever they have. You have a vague perception of what this might be. But when he says, I see men and I see them like trees walking around, this sort of indicates that this guy has had sight before. He's seen trees and he's seen men. And all of a sudden, it's more natural to say, and he was regaining his sight partially. Now, if you see men looking like trees walking around, you are probably still legally blind at this point. But it's infinitely better than seeing nothing. You're seeing shapes, and you're seeing distinctions in light, and you're seeing, you know, stuff. So something is happening here. Now, it says, then again, he, being Jesus, laid his hands on his eyes. And now all of a sudden we have three really neat little verbs in the Greek. And it's sort of a rapid-fire succession of what happens. My English version says that he laid his hands on his eyes and he looked intently. The word here is diablepo. We had anablepo, to see again, blepo being to see. Now we have diablepo, and the word dia is like dilate. When the doctor, the eye doctor, takes you in and he puts drops in your eyes and your pupils dilate, what happens? They go wide open, don't they? And then you really hope there's no bright lights in the room. In this case, diablepo means that all of a sudden this man can open his eyes wide. It's as if Jesus, not as if, it is that Jesus has removed the obstruction. Perhaps he had cataracts. Perhaps there was something wrong with the lens or the cornea or the optic nerves going back in the retina. Who knows? Whatever the case is that Jesus, in verb number one, has removed the obstruction. Secondly, the next little word is apoktemi. That's a nice little Greek word. Isn't it great we can read English? His eyes were opened, the obstruction was gone, and they were restored. Ah, this is the sense that health and full function was given back to eyes that had failed. Jesus has, in effect, recreated this man's eyes. The third little verb is another blepo, another word to see, ena blepo. And in this case, all of a sudden, he not only sees, but he sees everything clearly, with precision, with the implication of understanding. He now can properly understand what it is that he is looking at and appreciate what is before him. And who is able to do this for him? Only Jesus. Now, this is exactly what the 12 need for their spiritual sightedness, because they're getting spiritually blind. They need the obstruction removed. They need restored function. And they desperately need everything made clearly for them. But then Jesus does something really interesting. And we've noticed a number of times as we've been going through the Gospels that Jesus has told people, hey, don't say anything about this healing. Hey, don't say anything about this freedom from bondage. Keep it to yourself. And in this case, it says Jesus sent this now seeing man to his home. And he was saying, do not even enter the village. And of course, the question has to be why? This goes beyond just don't tell anybody. This is don't let anybody see you now that you can see. We've already discussed the fact of why Jesus was putting these prohibitions on people after they were receiving such incredible restorative touches from him. One of the things that we've said in the past is that, you know what? Jesus did not want people going out giving partial, incomplete, and misconstrued witness about him. In other words, if they, you know, attest to who this Jesus is, but they really don't know who he is, then all of a sudden you have to fight the misconceptions afterwards. Possibly. And the other thing that's kind of interesting is that in that day and age, there was already so much confusion and so much false messianic expectation in the Jews that to feed it only created a bigger problem. And a partial witness does exactly that. It perpetuates misconstrued conclusions. So here we have a man who is born blind, or I said he wasn't, a man who has become blind. He has had a progressive restoration of his sight and his understanding through Jesus alone. And then Jesus has given him this prohibition against being an incomplete witness for him. By the way, 6 months from this point, does anybody get told, don't witness? No. Why? What will happen 6 months from this point? You will start to understand exactly what Jesus' mission was, and you won't go out there and just say, hey, Jesus is a healer. You will say that Jesus is the risen Son of God who offers salvation. Now you have a much more effective, complete, focused witness. But the question is, as the 12 are witnessing themselves, this particular miracle, do you think they are seeing themselves in this illustration? I rather doubt it, but here comes the lesson anyway. Verse 27. Jesus went out, along with his disciples, to the villages of Caesarea Philippi. Now, I said, now you have left Lower Galilee. You are moving probably on the east side of the Jordan River. You're going up not to the big city of Caesarea Philippi, but to where? The villages. It's always interesting how Mark always has Jesus going to the villages. I mean, a lot of his ministry was done among the average folks. They were being called by God. God wasn't just calling the rich and the famous and the powerful and those who dominated in cities. He was calling the average man, the average woman. Anyway, they are off to the villages of Caesarea Philippi. That's about, oh, give or take 40 kilometers. And if the road's not all that smooth, that's a good 2 to 3 day walk with lots of time to stop and talk and teach and reflect. And so here comes the first question. Who do people say that I am? Now, what's Jesus asking? What is popular opinion about me? By the way, are we affected by popular opinion? Probably a whole lot more than we'd ever care to admit to. We get what's called news nowadays, which is very carefully packaged sound bites and highly biased. Whether you get it from the left or the right, it doesn't matter. I even kind of fear the stuff, the so-called Christian news, that it's also highly packaged and biased. But we get a lot of human opinion. And you know what? The problem with human opinion is it's about as good as the humans who give it, and we know that the humans who give it are probably not all that sharp. Sorry if you're the news business that I've offended you, or you're a journalist. Nowadays, I think journalists think that they're just the greatest thing since sliced bread because they are the purveyors of truth. And I think, yeah, right. So that puts me on a... That's why I don't get interviewed by anybody. Anyway, because I would just say, yeah, right, all the time. Who do people say that I am? Now, they have a ready response for this. And they told him. And they said, John the Baptist. Others say, Elijah. But others, one of the prophets. Now that is verbatim from back from chapter 6. When we have that little digression there where Mark tells us about what happened to John the Baptist. And Jesus has come onto the scene, and the wonderful miracle power of Jesus has come onto the scene. And who is the king of the region of Galilee? His name is also Herod, part of that family, Herod Antipas. Where is his capital city? You guys should know from Israel, the capital, Tiberias. About 8 o'clock on your clock at the Sea of Galilee, Tiberias. Where does Jesus do no ministry whatsoever? In the quadrant of Tiberias, which is interesting. We have no record of ministry. He does it just to the north of 9 o'clock, definitely, but nothing really to the south. So this is sort of the royal opinion, because when all of a sudden, when there is this miracle power and Herod Antipas has already put John the Baptist to death, how do you now explain that there is more miracle power going on? And what comes out of the capital of Galilee, out of the Tiberius opinion, is, and this is the human conclusion, that it has to be one of three things. It's either John the Baptist has come back to life, or it's Elijah, or it's one of the prophets. An old school prophet has come back. Now, who's John the Baptist? Well, from their human perspective, he would have been a moralist who was calling for repentance and baptized on that basis. Who is Elijah? Well, now Elijah is an interesting case, because if you read the last verses of the Old Testament, if you read in Malachi chapter 4, verses 5 and 6, what does it say? Before the day of the Lord comes, who comes? I will send Elijah. And what will he do? He will draw the hearts of the people back to their fathers, and the fathers back to the... There'll be some restoration happening there. So Elijah was this forerunner. He was a pre-Messiah figure. Now, of course, Jesus equates Elijah with who? John the Baptist, because John the Baptist is exactly that, the pre-Messiah introductory figure. And then some of them say, well, he's a prophet. This is sort of somebody who operates in God's power. Now, are any one of these descriptions of who Jesus is adequate or accurate? Is he, in fact, John the Baptist resurrected? No. Is he the Elijah who is coming to introduce the Messiah? Absolutely not. He is the Messiah. And is he just another operator in God's power, one of the old school prophets? Well, please tell me, which prophet ever did 100th of what Jesus did? No. He's none of the three. But that is public opinion. And you know what's really surprising here is that the Jews had been in an almost messianic frenzy for about 100 years. And there had been all kinds of false messiahs who had presented themselves and failed. And it had caused all kinds of political upheaval. The Romans had cracked down on things. And yet, even though they're in this messianic frenzy for 100 years, no popular human opinion seemed to identify Jesus as Messiah. That really does tell you exactly how good popular opinion is, isn't it? It's popular, but it ain't accurate. And yet Jesus is and does what none of these false messiahs had begun to do. Certainly up to that point, and certainly no one afterwards would. You see, Jesus is not just one more sent by God. That's how they saw the prophets. That's how they saw John the Baptist. That's how they saw Elijah. Just one more guy sent by God. Jesus is the one sent by God. You see, the expectations grew for who Messiah should be. In fact, with every failed Messiah, Jewish expectations grew. There was so much expectation in those days, people didn't really understand what Messiah was. There's that old joke that, you know, if you talk to three Jews about their opinion of Messiah, you'll get seven opinions. Multiple opinions. They couldn't agree. They still can't agree to this day on who Messiah should be. It's one of the problems that they have with Jesus. And Jesus is obviously far, far more than these three categorizations. And by this point, the 12 have spent 30 months with Jesus. That's a good long time to be in someone's influence, to be under someone's teaching. And you would assume that they should have an informed opinion. You see, what Jesus is doing here is he is going to set up the question. If he is the one sent by God, there is one big question. And you know what's interesting is that this question is really important. In fact, this is lesson number one. Lesson number one is, what is the most important question that any human being ever has to answer? And simply put, it is, who is Jesus? You can go back to Mark chapter 4, after Jesus calms the storm, when he's had that little nap and the boat's about to sink, and he calms the storm, and the disciples, driven by fear, say, who then is this? Well, that's the question that Mark's gospel answers all the way through. Who is this? Jesus is Messiah. Now, and it actually, the problem is that we have to get past popular opinion to answer that question. Because every Tom and his dog has an opinion about who Jesus is. But I have heard such bizarre things said when people answer, who is this Jesus? By the way, who actually can really define and explain and say who Jesus is? If he is the one sent, it's the one who sent him who can really define this. And God defines it clearly. What does, he continued questioning them, verse 29. Okay, that's public opinion, I understand. They're confused about who I am. But who do you, and the you there is plural, so he's asking the whole group, who do you say, after 30 months of being with me and seeing all that God has done and all that has been attested, who do you say that I am? So when Peter answers here, because it's a group question, understand that Peter is a spokesman and assume that they have had some group discussion about this. I mean, in the last 6 months, since they came out of that boat that was about to sink when Jesus is sleeping and he calms the storm and they ask the question, who then is this? I trust that this was a topic of conversation between these 12 guys. And they keep seeing what he's doing. And every day it's new and new. There's new teaching. There's new power. There's new authority. There are challenges that Jesus answers and dismisses. Who do you say that I am? So Peter answers, probably as a spokesman for the group. And he says to Jesus, you are the Christ. Ah. Now that's a good answer, isn't it? Compared to the other answers that have been given, John the Baptist and Elijah and a prophet, that's an excellent answer. You are the Christ. Now, if we flesh this out a little bit more with Matthew's gospel, Matthew 16, verses 16 to 17, Matthew says that Peter not only said, you are the Christ, but he said, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Ah! And Jesus' response to Peter is really interesting. Here we don't have a response in Mark's gospel, we certainly do in Matthew's gospel. Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, son of Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you. You didn't get this from human opinion. The opinion polls did not tell you this, Peter, or the rest of you guys. But who has revealed this? But my Father has revealed this to you. Here's lesson number two. All spiritual insight is God-given. No spiritual insight is man-discovered. You'll never get it in a multiplicity of humanistic teachers and from a multiplicity of human opinions. It just isn't going to come. The reality is that all spiritual insight is God-given, and God the Father had given Peter that insight.
Therefore, how imperative is it that they listen to Jesus? Absolutely imperative. And what's been the problem? They're not listening well enough. Now, at this point in time, I would say like Peter is like the blind man who is seeing trees walking around, men who look like trees. And you're saying, hey, that's being kind of hard on this description of Messiah. Well, let's not stop here. Peter sees, and God has revealed to him that Jesus is indeed Messiah. But what do you think obscures Peter's vision so that he is not able to sharply focus on the details that define Messiah? And I would say that we are obscured here, that Peter's vision is obscured, and the rest of them as well, by these human expectations, these Jewish traditional expectations of what Messiah should be. They've got such a wild compendium and grocery list of what Messiah should be, that even though they can identify him as Messiah, they really don't understand who Messiah is and what he's going to do. Now, usually these commands to silence are given to people who have just, you know, recently experienced who Jesus is. They're sort of new believers, new healies. In this case, now Jesus tells his own hand-picked 12, okay, I want you to be quiet about something. And he warned them to tell no one about him. Why? Well, I would suggest that at this point in time, even the disciples are not adequately informed enough to provide accurate witness, because they are so spiritually blind. Secondly, you really don't want to start stirring up political expectations. You notice that Jesus kind of goes out of his way not to do that, because that would get in the way of the things that God had sent him to accomplish. God did not send Jesus to accomplish political things. Not at that point. God will send Jesus in the future to accomplish some very political things. And simply put, it's not the right time. 6 months from now, after Jesus has gone to the cross, after God has raised Jesus from the dead, after the Holy Spirit has taken up residence in the lives of these apostles, now tell everyone you can everything you know. But up until this point, it's no. But then, we want to get to lesson number 3. And this is interesting, verse 31. This is sort of going to be our stopping point, and it'll be our pickup point for next week. Jesus began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the scribes, and that he will be killed, and that after 3 days he will rise again. Now let me tell you that the apostles have no contextual framework by which to accept this. They think Messiah is going to do what? He's going to come riding in on the war horse and stomp out the Gentiles and restore Israel back to prominence. That's their view of Messiah. And if he does a little healing on the side, isn't that a nice side benefit? But they are waiting for that political restoration. Remember, Jesus is about to ascend into heaven. What is one of the last questions his apostles ask him? Is this the time when you're restoring the kingdom to Israel? I'm so glad the Holy Spirit came to enlighten and direct, because they're still caught in that fixation. Fixation makes you blind, by the way. Anyway, what does Jesus say? He began to teach them. This is really the first time in Mark's gospel where Jesus begins to explain very clearly the purpose of God sending Messiah. This is all according to the plan of God. He began to teach them that the Son of Man... Now, when you read that, something needs to go off your mind. You need to have sort of a cross-reference in your mind. Which text do you go to when you read Son of Man? Daniel chapter 7. Daniel chapter 7. You get the beautiful throne room of heaven scene. Into the throne room of heaven, and you see God, the Almighty, and the angels and the heavenly court there. And who is led into the heavenly court? One who looks like a Son of Man. kind of looks kind of humble and average for the glory of what's going on in the court of heaven. But as he is let in, what is he given? Glory and power and authority, all the things that belong only to God. Which tells you something, that this one who looks like the Son of Man is in fact God. But represented a little bit differently. You see him a little differently. Jesus refers to himself as the Son of Man because he understands who he is. He is God, the Son of Man. Now, I don't know that the Jews necessarily equated Daniel 7 with Messiah. You hope they did. They should have. Anyway, this Son of Man, he looks like a man, but he's given all glory. Isn't that great? That's the way a Messiah should be. Full of glory, no pain, no suffering, no problems. By the way, we get a second picture of the Son of Man. In fact, we get probably what Paul saw on the road to Damascus was another perspective on that same Daniel vision, that he saw the Son of Man and the glory. When we get to Revelation chapter 4 and 5, once again, it's the same scene in heaven, little different perspective. Here is John, the apostle, who's getting the revelation, and he's a little upset because he doesn't know who can open the scroll that needs to be opened up. And all of a sudden, he sees something. Same vision, different perspective. He sees the Lamb who was slain, standing where? In the middle of the throne. And the heavenly host is praising him and giving him the glory. But you've got a lamb who is, or who was, slain. Which means that you've got a Messiah who suffers and dies. Ah. What Jesus says is the Son of Man, who is the one who is given all glory in Daniel 7 and who becomes this Lamb who was slain in Revelation 4 and 5. In between that, what happens? He must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the scribes, and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. To this day, the Jews struggle mightily with the whole idea of a suffering Messiah. And really what they need to do is have an honest read through Isaiah. Because Isaiah is broken up into three parts. You start off with the first part of Isaiah being the chronicle of the king who is to come. Then you have the second part of Isaiah being the chronicle of God's servant. And then you have the third part of Isaiah being the king who comes back to conquer. And in that middle section, the climax of that middle section is Isaiah 53. And Isaiah 53 is amazing because what does it talk about? It talks about God's righteous servant and how he suffers and how by his suffering God extends covenant and healing and restoration and forgiveness to his people. But it is only through this act of suffering, by his stripes, we are healed. By the way, I learned something really interesting when I was in Israel last time. Apparently, they have lectionaries or reading lists that the Jews kind of read through regularly so that they're reading their Old Testaments continuously. The rabbis produce these and distribute them. And one of the passages that seems to be conspicuously absent from most of these reading lists is Isaiah 53. Why? Because when you read Isaiah 53, if you know anything about Jesus at all, it is virtually impossible to say, oh, the suffering servant is actually Israel, not Jesus. Well, I'll tell you, Israel suffers, there's no doubt about that, but never by their suffering is anybody healed. Never by their suffering is anybody restored. They suffer because they bear upon themselves the curses of the covenant because they keep breaking the old covenant. But it's only in Jesus, it's only in the Messiah that there is the suffering servant who indeed bears upon himself the wrath of God so that God can then offer his forgiveness and grace. Jesus says, the Son of Man, he's going to suffer. He's going to be rejected by all the powers. He's going to be killed, and after 3 days, he's going to rise again. And all of the apostles fell down and said, "Hallelujah, blessed are you, Lord." No. No. The spokesman takes him aside and says, "May this never happen to you." You see, I'm cheating, but I'm going into verse 32. Jesus was explaining things plainly, it says. Telling them exactly what was about to happen. And this goes against everything they understand that Messiah should be. And Peter thinks he's doing a great service, and he's loving and kind towards Jesus, and says, "No!" And isn't it interesting how you can go in a space of a few verses from saying, "Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, for the Father has told you this," to being told, "Get behind me, Satan." You see, the suffering servant of God was not the Messiah that the 12 wanted, expected, or even began to understand. But they would. But they needed to see not only trees walking around, they needed to see the clear details of who Messiah would be. And that's what Jesus was beginning to teach in this last 6 months, is let's get beyond the trees and get to the details, so that you guys will be ready to be my witnesses. So lessons. Let me ask just about two of them here this morning as we close. Do we get this lesson? That there is an essential question. Essential for every individual in this room and essential for the entire world. The essential question is, who is Jesus? Do we understand the essential answer? The essential answer is kind of what Peter gave. You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God, sent by God to accomplish God's work in salvation. Now, I'm expanding what Peter said, obviously. But that is the essential answer to the essential question, is it not? That Jesus is the Son of the living God. He is sent by God, or was sent by God. He accomplished God's work once for all, and it resulted in salvation and reconciliation. There's the essential answer. Now, if you understand the essential question, that's good. If you understand the essential answer, that's even better. But now, don't stop there, because we do need to have some essential understanding. This is where we don't want to get inoculated. What else do we need to know? And we need to know that Jesus is indeed God's suffering servant, and only he can bring reconciliation, because only he can make the adequate payment to satisfy the wrath of God, and only he can transfer his righteousness into our account so that we indeed can be justified. You see, it pushes a little farther. A little farther. Now, second lesson, all spiritual insight is humanly deduced, right? Oh, you got to be saying wrong now. All spiritual insight is always God-given, and we know that he has given it through his word, that this is the final expression of everything that we need for faith and practice. Here it is. Therefore, we need to be in the word, and we need to be very wary of human opinion, including evangelical tradition. And there's lots of evangelical tradition that is nothing more than human opinion dressed up as orthodoxy. You could spend 4 or 5 sermons on that one. All spiritual insight is God-given through his word. Beware of the human opinion. It will lead us astray. We want Jesus to say, the Father has revealed that to you. We don't want Jesus to say, get behind me. Because you've bought into something, though you think it's good and kind and useful. This is contrary to the truth of God, and the truth of God is clearly expressed in the scripture that he's given us. Let us stay with God's truth and God's opinion and not get swept away or distracted or even worse, corrupted by human opinion.